Joseph Garcia is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Garcia to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for more than a third of all U.S. executions. Execution Watch host Marlo Blue, with criminal defense attorneys Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, Jack Lee, and Paige Yannick. Huntsville Report outside the death house, Linda Huhan. And special guest Gloria Rubeck, with an update on the questions surrounding the source of the state's killer drug. The execution watch for Joseph Garcia begins. Don't you know they're killing people? Don't you know they're killing people? Don't you know they're killing people? Don't you know they're killing people?
Good evening, and welcome to the Tuesday, December 4th, 2018 edition of Execution Watch. Whether you're listening live on one of our FM channels, 90.1 FM Houston, 89.7 Huntsville, or simulcast and archived at kpft.org, thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Marlo Blue. As many of you know, Ray Hill, civil rights, prisoner advocate, and co-creator of this program, died on November the 30th, 2018. Before we begin tonight's show, we would like to start with a message from our executive producer, Elizabeth Stein, and the crew here at Execution Watch. If you are tuning in for Nuestra Palabra with your host, Tony Diaz, usually heard here every Tuesday from 6 to 7 p.m., please check back next week when it resumes its regularly scheduled slot. Elizabeth.
Hey, Marlo, thank you. Yeah, it feels kind of strange. This is our first show since Ray passed away, which he would hate my saying that because he said, no, I'm going to die when I die. So, but he's not here to correct me. Anyway, Ray passed away a week ago Saturday in hospice care. There was a huge public funeral for him because I don't know if you know this about Ray, but he was kind of a celebrity in Houston for his advocacy work for the gay community and also for the criminal justice community. But interestingly, he often called this show the most political thing he'd ever done. He and I started the show about almost 11 years ago, and Ray was very committed to the idea that we need to tell people what it's really like, the way the death penalty is really administered in Texas, as opposed to the public relations version. And speaking of PR, we also wanted to show that the prisoners in death row are not monsters, as politicians like to say. They're humans, and we wanted to show their humanity. And Ray was very excited whenever he got to interview somebody in death row, had a date. I mean, it's up to them whether we interview them, but he always got very excited about that. So we're going to miss him. Marlo Blue's been doing a great job filling in for him. And bon voyage, Ray.
Bon voyage across the River Styx, Ray. Thank you, Elizabeth. We welcome your opinions on social media and beyond. To learn more about the death penalty and executions in the state of Texas, you can join us on Facebook at Execution Watch or online at executionwatch.org. Please join our mailing list for all of the latest updates. Well, tonight we stand in vigil as the state of Texas plans to execute Joseph Garcia for the killing of Irving police officer Aubrey Hawkins during a Christmas Eve robbery. A very high-profile case, Garcia will be the fourth of the so-called Texas Seven inmates executed after the group escaped from the Connolly unit in 2000. There were seven co-defendants: Patrick Murphy, George Rivas, Randy Halperin, Larry Harper, Michael Rodriguez, and Donald Newberry. joining us in the studio tonight to put this case in perspective is our panel of experts, Larry B. Douglas, Mike Gillespie, Jack Lee, and Paige Yannick. This program is the first and only live electronic vigil where we provide firsthand reports of the Texas death machine in action. We appreciate those of you joining us internationally and on the World Wide Web. And we join with those of you who stand in vigil on the streets of Texas cities and in front of the death house in Huntsville. Our reporter, Linda Hujan, joins us now live by phone from outside of the death house in Huntsville. Linda, how are you tonight? And please describe the scene for us.
Well, it's very somber. I mean, Joseph has about 12 people here on his standing here, very somber. We're very sad that it looks like it's going to go through. It looks like everything has been denied. They have not crossed the line yet. I don't know what. There's a lot of police officers on the other side. The motorcycles have come through in force. And this is not a happy scene tonight.
Well, of course, with that line of blue on the other side, or the figurative line of blue, has there been any tension between people who are protesting for this execution to not go off?
Not really. It's been pretty peaceful. We had one lady that came over here that when she realized that she was on the wrong side, she took off, kind of running.
Right.
But that was it. There's been no fights or anything.
And
no bad words.
The witnesses or the people who are standing in support of Joseph, do you know their relationship in particular to Joseph Garcia?
Some very close friends.
Mm-hmm.
And his attorneys.
Yeah.
And then all of us from the prison show.
Well, good and excellent. I'm assuming is Mike Lewis there as well? Is he?
No, Mike had to work tonight.
Is anybody streaming it tonight?
Yes, Danny is streaming it on Facebook Live.
Can you give us that information of the Facebook account so people can check in if they'd like to?
It's the Prison Show Live.
Prison Show Live?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Well, thank you, Linda. And please let us know when you receive word. We'll be standing by for your report.
Okay, I'll call you back.
Thank you. Let's go to Mike Gillespie for some insight. Mike, Joseph says he's innocent. Tell us his story.
Well, innocent from a moral viewpoint, based upon all the facts, he did not kill this police officer. It seems like, and let's go back to some history for this man. In 1996, he murdered somebody and received 50 years in prison for murder. Within 4 years, he was part of the famous Texas Seven. And if we remember, the Texas Seven was a famous group of inmates who escaped from TDC. There were seven of them. They stole weapons, automatic weapons, and guns, and trucks, and escaped and got away. They did this in December. By Christmas Eve, they needed some money, and they tried to rob an Ostrom store, which is a sporting goods store. In the process of robbing the store, they set off an alarm, and a policeman came out, a policeman called Officer Hawkins. Officer Hawkins pulled up, and he was immediately multiple rounds of gunshot. He was killed. According to the testimony, there's no direct testimony that Mr. Garcia was one of the people who used the gun. There was some testimony that Mr. Garcia was inside the store and wasn't part of it. That was ignored during the trial because we in Texas have something called law of parties. What that basically means is if me and Jack decide to rob a bank and Jack gets killed by the police, I go to jail for his murder because I set in effect a course of occurrences that caused Jack's death. The law of parties is very much disrepute right now. I might go back. We had a few months ago a guy called Robert Pruitt who went to jail for the law of parties, and that to me was a horrible case because his father killed a neighbor and he was 15. He got 99 years in prison because his father killed a neighbor. The father only got 45 years, but he got 99. I understand the theory that if you're part of a criminal episode and something happens, everybody's responsible. But it's a little bit different. Like I said, if me and a co-defendant rob a bank and the police kill him, I go to jail because the police killed my partner. In this one specific case, we're not dealing with jail time. We're dealing with the death penalty. We all know that we're anti-death penalty. We don't think the death penalty should be there. But most... Okay.
Not all of us.
Okay.
I'm anti-death penalty the way we're doing it now.
Okay. I'm anti-death penalty because I feel that life in prison is a short time to lament your sins and be ready for the hereafter. Ray often said, and I think he was right, the men we kill are not the same men that committed the crime.
Well,
Locking a man in a cell and keeping him away from drugs and alcohol can change a man.
You want to be perfectly honest about it. All of our cells die, and it's replicated every 2 weeks. Every 2 weeks, we're different people.
I thought it was 60 days, but if it's 2 weeks, I'm in a lot of trouble.
More important, gentlemen, I mean, the motto on the TDCJ website is to provide public safety, promote positive change in offender behavior, reintegrate offenders into society, and assist victims of crimes. How does capital punishment achieve these goals, Jack?
Assisting victims of crime, it gives them a sense of closure. It gives them a sense of, for lack of better words, it satisfies society's bloodlust.
The trouble with all of this, I'm going to bring up a side thing. I saw in the paper last week that this guy, Whitey Bulgese out of Boston, was killed in prison. Bulger was killed in prison. He was a professional hitman. He wasn't given the death penalty. He was given prison time in federal prison. While he's in federal prison, he is killed by other mafia hitmen in prison. So if we're killing anybody, shouldn't we be executing hitmen? People who are so callous about people's lives, they do it for money? We're talking about people who commit crimes and things get out of control. If we're going to execute them, why are we executing hitmen for?
I'd like to continue with this, but first I'd like to ask a couple of more questions about tonight's case. Of course, at this moment, the state of Texas is either preparing Joseph Garcia for this execution. I'm under the impression that as of November the 30th, his last challenge for the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles was rejected.
Which gets to 2 points that we want to talk about. The first thing we'd like to talk about is a Board of Pardons and Paroles, and I think Paige can talk about that. I was kind of shocked to find out how many people on the Board of Pardons and Paroles are ex-police officers. How are you getting a fair shake on something like this when you're being judged by ex-police officers? Now, Paige, you got a comment about that?
Well, the Board of Pardons and Paroles is part of the executive branch of government. The members of the Board of Pardons and Paroles are appointed, they're not elected, and it is not a matter of popular vote in order to appoint members of the Board of Pardons and Paroles. Since the executive is responsible for the appointment,
And the executive in this case is the head of the TDCG or Abbott?
Well, the governor is the chief executive officer of the state of Texas. Mm-hmm. Some might say the lieutenant governor is, but be all that as it may, these are appointed positions. And it is not uncommon, nor is it surprising, that the members of the Board of Pardons and Paroles could be constituted by former TDCJ officials.
But how is that fair?
I don't know that it's fair, and I don't know that the Board of Pardons and Paroles is designed to be fair.
Well, I think it should be designed to be fair.
All right, let's talk about what you think ought to happen as opposed to what does.
Next term, I'll run for governor and come up with a platform on it. But to start off with, you need a balancing act. You can't put into the courts all judges who are hard on crime. You need a balancing act. You can't have
Well, but judges are elected.
Well, they get appointed before they get elected.
No,
not all the time.
In this last slate, almost none of the, in Harris County, almost none of the judges were previously appointed before
they
got elected
in.
One
steps down.
I think you're right, this term of court, but I think appointment is a way to become a judge, and once you're in, you stay in. All I'm me is, and maybe that's a bad example using judges.
Well,
but I do
but
think
it didn't happen with the election.
But I do think it's and I never knew that ratio until I read about it. I just think you can't have fair bargains of paroles to make these decisions, especially on somebody killing a police officer.
Let's switch back, Mike, and I'd like to know a little bit more about what you were telling us about the law of parties, because this is, in common language, explain this to me and why it's important here.
It's exactly what I said. The courts feel that if you set into action a course of events, you're responsible for what you did. If I drive a car and I'm drinking, I'm responsible for running over a pedestrian. The same theory is that if me and somebody else plan a bank robbery and people are hurt, we're all responsible for what happened. I don't think that's fair. I don't think the law of parties is a good law. I was very interested in the dissent that came out last week by the Texas court.
What was that?
17-page dissent on the law of parties. And it was a strong dissent. It was such a strong dissent by the judge that I thought we might even get a stay today, because to me it's a big issue. It's one thing about putting a man in jail under law of parties, but to execute him because somebody else pulled the trigger, I think is totally unfair.
You've already quoted a previous case that recently disposed of. Do you think that this is going to be used more and more, this law of parties?
I think the law of parties has always been used. It's a standard that Texas uses. And again, I'm not saying it's wrong. If three people decide to do a burglary, and during the course of the burglary, one of the co-defendants kills the homeowner, we're all responsible for it. I just don't think that should be a death penalty case. Can we say that we all planned to do the burglary? That he happened to be the lookout man with the gun who shot? Yeah. I can see we're all responsible. But we're talking about the death penalty.
Now, of course, Joseph Garcia has said that he was not the one who shot.
He says he was in the
Aubrey,
back, that he was not out there. Only from all evidence, there was five of them that were at the ambush, and that's when the police officer was killed.
So if that's the case, Mike, I mean, everybody's going to be fighting to be the wheelman at the bank robbery.
We're not talking about escaping from going to jail. We're talking about the death penalty.
I understand. So if you and I are going to go rob a bank, I'm going to insist that I be the wheelman, because if I'm the wheelman, there is no way I can pull a trigger.
Larry Douglas.
I mean, right.
What can you add to this conversation?
Well, Texas uses the law of parties in death penalty cases more than any other state. Probably more than all other states combined. We suddenly got enamored with applying it to death penalty cases. And this case raises the question of how far do you take the law of parties as it relates to death penalty cases? How many people have to lose their lives for the loss of one life? This is now the third already has been executed. He's Garcia's the fourth. For the murder of the one man, and that raises a question of fairness.
Is this a case of the law not being blind?
Oh, the law is being applied. Okay, the law is being applied as it reads currently.
But let me ask you a question: if they were not escaped convicts, if it was just a robbery, would we be talking about death penalty because the policeman was killed?
Well, you could be, okay, because the law of parties is used in all kinds of cases, and it's based on prosecutorial discretion. But what the law of parties does is it relieves the state of the burden of showing who did the killing if there are several people involved, and he was killed.
Gentlemen, thank you. We're going to continue this discussion. The time is now 6:20, and currently we have Linda Hujan back on the line reporting from Huntsville. Linda, you're calling us back way too fast.
Oh, sorry.
Can you please tell us what's happening there in Huntsville? You are our eyes and ears.
Okay, the witnesses have crossed the line. They've gone into the death house. So it is fixing to happen.
All right, dear. Thank you. Would you please let us know when they come out?
I sure will.
Thank you so much. That was Linda Hujan reporting from Huntsville. If you are just joining us now and looking for Nuestra Palabra with Tony Payan, he is not here today. Tony Diaz will be back next week in the regularly scheduled time. We just heard from our reporter in front of the death house, Linda Hujan, that the witnesses for Joseph Garcia have crossed over. We assume that the execution will happen momentarily. Let's get back to this very interesting conversation, and I would like you all to know that we will be also talking a little bit later on with Gloria Rubick and talk about some action that's been going on here in town in about 3 or 4 minutes. I'm sorry, Larry, we left off with you. Let's go with you.
Well, the way the law of parties operates, it eliminates the distinction between accomplices and principals and so forth. If during the course of committing a felony, another felony, whether you intended on
this is a felony because it's law enforcement?
The robbery
of the guns
of the Oshman store, and so there is no need under the law of parties to prove who actually committed the murder, or even that the person who is being charged intended for the murder to occur, so long as it's reasonably expected when you go to commit a robbery, a killing can occur. So all of that's dispensed with, and the fact that you could not have committed the offense, the murder, is not a defense. Even if he's in the back and could not have done it, well, it resulted. It was the result of a robbery in which you were engaged. So even if you were not even physically at the location where the murder was occurred, you cannot use that as a defense. So it dispenses with the state's obligation to proving a lot of different things.
So what we're saying is judicial efficiency is easier to kill them all than try them all.
I'm not sure exactly what that means.
I think it's more legislative efficiency. The legislators in constructing 1902 went ahead and put it together so that at punishment, you can consider the actions of all parties. And if they jointly participate willingly, anticipating that death could result, and it does, then at that point, the burden of proof is done once the jury answers the special issue.
But isn't it just a negotiation point for the DA? And what I mean by that is three people commit a home robbery and somebody is killed. Nobody's talking. The state doesn't know who killed them. Using the law of parties should be enough to put pressure on people to fess up who the person is who fired the gun so the others are not charged with it. It's more like a hammer.
I have a feeling that in this Dallas County murder, nobody in the DA's office really was focused in on proving individualized guilt.
I agree with you, but I'm also saying I could see how the legislator will put that in effect when you have three people and nobody knows who pulled the trigger, so you charge everybody until you find out enough to figure out who. But you shouldn't do it as a matter of course. You shouldn't do it because the prisoners who escaped and the person killed was a police officer. Larry?
Jack. That's right. Mike, I think you're giving the legislature way more credit than they have. I mean, than they have going on in their heads. This is, if you're a legislator, what you're trying to do is appeal to your ability to be reelected. And it's a real easy script. I'm going to get tough on crime. How do you get tough on crime? You make everybody guilty of something. It's real simple. And because of that, we have laws written the way they are. Everybody's guilty of something. Everybody's committing a crime every day. It's just a question of which one.
But isn't capital punishment now the third rail?
What do you mean?
As Texas turns more and more blue, as Texas and other areas besides just the urban areas turn more and more to the aspect of rights, and we have the opportunity to go ahead and do life without parole, hasn't capital punishment, and especially capital punishment that's been administered incorrectly, become the third rail of politics in Texas, especially rural
yeah,
Texas?
I don't think it pops up on the radar screen nearly as much as some folks would like to think.
And what would you think does instead?
Well, it depends on if you're on the left or on your right. You know, first several elections ago, healthcare was the biggest issue. It's almost always the economy, and that's the biggest issue. There's going to be, you know, I mean, the right tried to make an issue with transgender bathrooms last election cycle. I mean, the death penalty is rarely something that pops up the radar screen.
The time is right now 6:27. You are listening to KPFT 90.1 FM. This is Execution Watch. I'm here tonight with Mike Gillespie, with Larry Douglas, with Jack Lee, and Paige Yannick. And we're talking about the execution, which apparently is taking place at this moment for Joseph Garcia. Larry, you look like you have something to say.
Well, the public's attitude is changing toward the death penalty for several different reasons. Even adamant supporters of the death penalty have recognized now that it is not justly applied in all cases. There have been people who were on death row and have been shown to be not guilty, being innocent. So the Innocence Project has caused people to rethink this issue. Jim used to always like to say that you know, if Andrea Yates had been Andy Yates, he'd be dead already. It's you know, males are more likely to be put to death, sought the death penalty than females, and blacks more than whites. Yep. And because of the errors, and I think the public is sort of a little bit fatigued about the application, because it's just not equally applied. Having said that, though, and even in Harris County, we are seeking the death penalty a lot less now than a few years ago.
Yeah.
But having said that, you know, we've got seven escaped long-term criminals who,
so with automatic weapons and a lot of ammunition,
stole a lot of weapons.
44 automatic
including
weapons,
AK-47s.
Yes. Right around Christmas time, escaped on December 10th, whatever, and
December 13th,
and then Christmas Eve.
They committed this robbery at Oshman's Christmas Eve,
and then they were on the run for 5 weeks. So this was a story that I really played out in the public a lot. I think no matter where they were, the death penalty would have been sought.
It was big news. It was splashed everywhere.
And the public was concerned about that. Now, but when you consider that there were six survivors, because one committed suicide, do you have to seek the death penalty on all of them? This is the now, apparently, we're looking at the fourth one. You know, there's, you know, Aubrey Hawkins was killed, and that's a tragic situation. A police officer was. But now it looks like we're going to execute the fourth person. And this law of parties, I mean, you don't even have to charge the actor in order for another person's law of parties. The actual killer doesn't even have to be charged.
Well, in this case, they were all charged with capital murder.
Exactly.
All surviving members of the seven, all six of them, were charged and convicted of capital murder.
Correct.
So let's give an example. Let's say there's a husband and wife, and let's say they need money. And so the husband and wife make a plan to rob a supermarket. The wife scopes out the supermarket. the wife is involved in the planning and the husband goes and does it. Should she be given the death penalty because he shot somebody during the robbery?
She actually doesn't get, because remember, you have two components. You have mens rea and you have actus rea. If all she does is help plan, there is no actus rea. So if she helps plan, she's not, no matter what happens, she'll never get charged. There is
she
no actual
be part
action.
Of a conspiracy?
Ah, that's conspiracy. That's a different issue. You cannot get the death penalty on conspiracy.
All right, let's take a little break for just a second.
Well, I'm glad the courts agree with me.
The time is 6:31. While we await to hear from Linda Hujan, let's bring up another part of this puzzle. In 2011, Reprieve, a London-based advocacy group, began calling on European pharmaceutical companies who produced drugs used in lethal cocktails to execute prisoners to stop allowing their drugs use. With both overseas and U.S. manufacturers now enforcing their rights to stipulate prohibition of their drug in executions, the era of easily available lethal drug cocktails began to wind down. Now, with stockpiles running thin, some states have turned to so-called boutique pharmaceutical companies to provide the chemicals needed. According to a BuzzFeed News article published November the 28th, local manufacturer Green Park Pharmacy in Bel Air, Texas, was one of the new, never-before-named suppliers filling the gaps. On Monday, a group of activists protested the local manufacturer. Joining us now by phone is Gloria Rubik, activist to abolish the death penalty. Gloria, tell us about the protest yesterday.
Okay. It was great. The pharmacy, the compounding pharmacy, and what compounding pharmacies are, and I didn't know this till it became a secret who was making execution drugs, but they're pharmacies that mix their own potions. They don't take Eli Lilly off the shelf or whatever. So, because there is not a single manufacturer that will allow their drug to be used for execution anymore, Texas is using these compounding pharmacies, which are not regulated by the USDA or anybody else. So when we found out from BuzzFeed that Green Park Pharmacy was making the drugs, we had a press conference and a protest outside of their pharmacy. It's in a little strip center across from Whole Foods on Bel Air. And the owner was quite indignant and came out and said, well, y'all have made a mistake. We're not making these drugs.
What else did they say?
Huh?
They said they weren't making them. What else did they say?
Well, I'm assuming it was the owner, but I don't know. He said, you have the wrong information. We're just testing them. And I'm like, all right, you're still taking part in executions, whatever.
Yeah.
But I don't think that BuzzFeed would have put out three or four articles now about this pharmacy and about the compounding lethal injection solution.
Okay, Gloria,
if it
so
wasn't
you had this protest, you had a press conference to bring attention to this Green Park Pharmacy. Tell us what's next.
What's next is we are going to shut them down if they don't say, if we can find out if they really, and I've got an email to the BuzzFeed guy. If he's positive they're making the drugs, we're going to shut them down. When we were live streaming yesterday, we had people all over the country watching us.
Mm-hmm.
They want the address, the phone number, the email. So we're going to have a campaign. I think this Friday we're going to do Phone In Friday and have people from all over the place call them and tell them, stop making the drugs or we're going to shut you down. We're going to have an email day. We're going to have a fax day.
How can people contact you to know how to participate in this?
Well, I think the best thing would be to look at our Facebook page. And it's the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement. And we will be putting this information up. We already have their address and phone number and fax number on there. So far, we haven't found an email, but we're working on that.
Okay. Well, usually on the evening of an execution, you're in Huntsville in front of death row. Tell us what's going on tonight in here in Houston.
Okay, tonight is the first Tuesday of the month, and that's when the abolition movement has been meeting for the last 25 years. So, in December, we don't actually have a meeting. We have a holiday party and a card signing. And we are signing holiday cards for the 226, I think, people on death row, plus people who have had their sentences commuted, plus all of the ones that were juveniles that were taken off death row in 2005 by the Supreme Court. So people are going to bring bunches, and we're going to sign with all kinds of colorful pens and put stickers and stamps and everything on the cards. And we're going to include an execution schedule, because there's still, and actually you said Nuestra Palabra would be on next week, but there's actually an execution next Tuesday.
Oh, that's right. I'm so sorry. Of course. Absolutely.
And then there's...
Hopefully not, though. I mean, we're still hoping for a stay, if that's possible.
But there's one scheduled. And then there's already, I think, three or four scheduled for 2019.
It's amazing there's so many already.
Yeah. So we usually have, I don't know, 20, 30, 40 people here, I guess.
And people can still come. There's still time to do so.
I just pulled up to shape.
Okay, yeah, so... Bring your nice pens. Bring something to share, perhaps.
Yeah.
And
want to make a donation. We bought all the stamps.
Excellent.
We wanted to get the holiday stamps and the Kwanzaa stamps and the Hanukkah stamps.
Nice.
And we've got all the cards. So if people want to pitch in a few bucks for this, help us pay for the stamps, that would be great. Or stop and get some whatever, some yummy goodies.
Gloria Rubik, thank you so much for joining us tonight. We appreciate your time, as always.
Okay, thanks, Marlo.
Thank you. Let's go back to our panel, please, with Larry B. Douglas, Jack Lee, Mike Gillespie, and Paige Yannick. Who would like to start?
Let me talk about ineffective assistance of counsel. I call this the kitchen sink argument, because it's when you're dealing with defense counsel at in capital murder cases, one, they're usually public defenders. Two, they're usually exceptionally good at what they do. They dedicate so much of their intellectual horsepower, their lives, and into these cases that, frankly, ineffective assistance of counsel, despite what everyone think and everyone feels, doesn't actually rarely ever works. Specifically in an effective assistance of counsel, the rule is based upon the case, the Strickland test. It's basically two prongs. The first prong is within the wide standard of what would be acceptable, what would be reasonable lawyerly strategy and behavior and action and so on, that it has to be beyond a very wide range, which means they have to behave in such a way that frankly none of these attorneys would ever do. That's the first standard. It has to be beyond this range of what is considered reasonable. The second standard is the mistake that they made has to have made an impact. Something that would cause somebody to go, you know what, that would have a substantial effect on the jury's verdict. And unfortunately, you're throwing pebbles. Most of the things that are brought up in ineffective assistance of counsel, you're throwing pebbles at a steel box. It's just not going to happen. For example, you've got one issue here on ineffective assistance of counsel, where the trial attorney should have objected to the beyond reasonable doubt standard for mitigating evidence. The argument is so specious. The argument that you're making is that beyond reasonable doubt, this person let me prove beyond reasonable doubt that this person should not get, doesn't have enough to be mitigating evidence. You're effectively saying that the beyond reasonable doubt standard is you have to prove beyond reasonable doubt that in order to get to life in prison as opposed to death penalty. It just doesn't make any sense. But, you know, the under the circumstances, ineffective assistance of counsel is a kitchen sink. You're throwing as much as you can at really a difficult case. And in this case, the trial attorneys probably did their jobs exceptionally well. And on top of that, you know, cases where let me give a broader perspective on these death penalty cases. When you have a death penalty case, when somebody actually gets the death penalty, it's usually an I crime. It's usually a what on earth happened. It's a crime that hits you in the gut that the public would find so offensive that there's a call for bloodlust. In this case, you had people who were sentenced to prison. And they escape from prison. They escape from prison, and then in a robbery, they killed a police officer. This is something that would offend most people out there. You know, if you peel away your moral objection to the death penalty, this is something that I think, you know, some people would say, you know what, I want bloodlust here. I want somebody to die for this. I'm not suggesting that it's right. But I'm certainly not suggesting that it's wrong. I am suggesting that it is
of human nature.
It's a part of human nature. And given the barometer of our civilization right now, you know, it's part of us. Absolutely, we're moving away from the death penalty. And I mentioned, I think it was a couple of years ago, that if the guys on death row can hold on for several more years, that they're probably going to get commuted to life in prison.
Well, that's another question. I mean, certainly more and more, especially as we run into these problems with the methods of execution, certainly since the life without parole is available, more and more of these will change.
Life without parole has always been available.
Mm-hmm.
You put them into a cell and individually, effectively solitary. Honestly, I'd rather they just give me a lethal injection and die.
Jack Lee, you're making me lose hope. Mike Gillespie?
I agree with Jack.
Yeah.
I agree with Jack.
Larry, what about you?
Just a couple of things. We are moving away from using the death penalty in these kinds of cases. But when you look at the you have to look at the cases, I guess, based on when they occurred. Ineffective assistance of counsel. There have been some very ineffective counsel in the past. Okay, the standards of the counsel have changed within the last 10-15 years. It takes a long time sometimes to carry out the death sentence. So those cases that are 20 years old, some of them had pretty bad lawyers. And the other thing we have to look at is that this is an art form, not a science. And I have never tried a case where after the fact I thought I should have done this, should have done that. This might have played different because it just depends upon the feel you get. And so when somebody comes back after you and starts to grade your papers and figure out what you did, might have done right, might have done wrong, that changes things a lot. In this case, these issues have been looked at now on a death penalty matter four times. The 1, 2, 3, this is the fourth one. And I can't imagine looking at a transcript that some lawyer tried and not finding that there might be something there that might be that I like to try to see if this is ineffective assistance of counsel. Now, as Jack mentioned, you've got to have substantially subpar performance on the part of the lawyer, and that would have made a difference. The outcome would have been different. So it creates the image of of unfairness. It challenges the fairness of the system. But you, when you look at what somebody else has done, sometimes you can find something. But because these are appeals that have been going through over and over, the appellate lawyers have to be creative. And so when you look at, well, you know, are the drugs the right drugs to be used, or do they constitute cruel and unusual punishment? Is the Board of Pardons and Paroles, you start to be creative. Maybe, I mean, they're supposed to be a reflection of the citizenry. And if they don't, can we challenge that? So appellate lawyers, especially if for ground that has been plowed over and over, when you're going through looking for new material, you just have to be creative. And I think these lawyers, at least to the point where they had got Judge Alcala to say, you know, maybe there's something here. That's really what it's all about. That's what appellate lawyers do.
Well, is this going to end up just being the last man standing? I hate to say that, but will it not happen until they actually are ready to execute the sixth one?
I see this stuff over and over, and the results occasionally just surprise me. I just don't know what's going to happen with 5 and 6. You just don't know. Something might come up, or legislative changes might occur.
God only knows what to predict with 5 and 6 in this particular murder. But I think that the interesting thing is that this was tried in Dallas County. This is not a teeny tiny county. This is a big county. And there are a slew of highly qualified capital murder defendant counsels in Dallas County. And there was no dearth of finding a good participant. And truthfully, grading his papers, I don't see a major flaw. There are things that do not shock the conscience, and that's a phrase patented by judges, but do not shock the conscience on appeal about the performance of the attorney at trial.
All right, right. And that's why the appellate lawyer has to be so creative.
The time is now 6:48. You are listening to KPFT 90.1 FM, a very special episode of Execution Watch. We have Linda Hujan on the line, standing in front of the Death Row House in Huntsville. Linda.
Yes. They have just now come out of the death chamber. It's now over.
Thank you, Linda. We appreciate that. And I assume that at this point everyone's leaving. The body will be released into the chapel, and the witnesses will be allowed to be with Joseph Garcia.
For the first time, we will actually be able to touch him. Yes.
Linda, thank you. Do you have anything else to let us know? Of course, we do hope that you'll be there next week when... we will be broadcasting Alvin Brazil Jr.'s execution as well.
Yes, I will be here. Well, I'll be here.
Thank you, Linda. And, of course, you can join Linda or any of the other protests that happen around the city of Houston on street corners, on different areas, if you want to be involved in the death penalty or the abolishment of the death penalty. There are lots of organizations for you to join right here and now. Mike Gillespie, we've got about 10 minutes to wrap all of this up. And tell us your thoughts, please. Well, give us a little hope.
My first thought is, let's assume they run out of drugs. Let's assume that the two men of the seven who are still in prison end up getting life and not executed. They might have been the ones who actually fired the gun, and this guy did it. How do they decide which ones go first?
Mike, I believe that all six were sentenced to death.
That's right. But if the two left are commuted because there's no drugs, or as Larry says, the times are changing, can we actually be letting people live who were who actually pulled the trigger, and this guy died. And by all accounts, there was no evidence that he was out there. There was only five out there.
Well, there doesn't need... That's what the law part is all about, Mike. There doesn't need to be individualized findings of actual action. But what I'm saying,
is it fair when the smoke clears that the last one standing get life in prison and they were more of a, using the gun than he was?
And that's a concern that makes a lot of sense. But not only in this case, the law of parties makes it so flexible that if the DA wanted to seek the death penalty on three and not the other three, they could do that. I mean, they could, it's left up to the DA, the prosecutorial discretion in these areas to decide in this case who lives or dies. They can decide, and oftentimes the law of parties is used where, you know, one guy just has his lawyer get to the DA first and cut a deal, and that has happened time and time again in all kinds of cases, not just death penalty cases. You get your client, if there's a bunch of people involved, you get your client to the DA first and get your deal cut. Then the deal is sealed, and your guy might be the most culpable, but if you get there first and you get the deal, then that's the deal.
Again, jail time is one thing, execution is another thing. I think there needs to be a higher standard for executions.
And I think the public's moving that way for a lot of different reasons, including things like activism, as we've been talking about tonight. I mean, coalition to abolish the death penalty, and that effort is being pursued on lots of different fronts, and legislative, but you can't underestimate the power of the activist, and the activists have gotten even the challenging the drugs. Okay, it was done in the law, but it was motivated by activism. This is an activist argument. Mm-hmm. The arguments on appeal were predominantly activist arguments, more so than legal arguments.
Yes, but the legal argument that obtains right now and has become very interesting since 2007 when we instituted life without parole. And as a result, capital murders committed after the effective date of the statute have had an option of sentencing life without parole. And many of the smaller counties in Texas utilize life without parole if they go so far as to charge a capital murder.
I want to point out something that I think hasn't really been brought up. Juries make the determination, answer the special special questions, which, for lack of better words, commit somebody to death or not. The jury is supposed to be a representation of the population. If the in this case, the population wants somebody to die, and this is part of our judicial system. It's the judicial system reflects the mores and desires of our people. That our civilization is moving away from the death penalty. Well, this is a process that's going to take, honestly, it's going to take a long time. It's not going to be tomorrow. It's not going to be in a year. It's not going to be in two. It might be 5 or 10.
But aren't we really pretty far along on that road right now over the last 20 years? So many states.
We just executed someone, so I don't think
Texas
we are.
Texas is still not changed. But hasn't America changed the death penalty?
Texas has changed quite a bit from, say, 20 years ago. America has changed quite a bit from 20 years ago. You know, if you want to look at, where the East and the West Coast have are as a relation to the flyover states are pretty static. And frankly, so are the left and right coast of the United States. They've been pretty static.
Well, you have to admit, though, with some of the mass shootings, with some of the incredible carnage that's been happening in our schools and in our systems, every time we take two steps forward to end and abolish the death penalty, there appears to be a reason that brings it back into the public consciousness.
I'm not seeing a connection there.
You're not seeing from mass shootings to making people want that bloodlust you were just talking about?
No.
That's fascinating. And I think it might be a little blind, because if we are constantly bombarded by the killing urges of strange lone gunmen and a constant basis,
you have
that
to understand that these things happen
scared
in gun-free zones. Gunmen generally don't go to non-gun-free zones for mass shootings. It just doesn't happen.
But you don't think that has any kind of call to help pull back? Well, this is another discussion we'll have another day. I want to wrap up Execution Watch for today. Please join us on December the 11th, 2018 at 6 p.m. when the state of Texas plans to execute Alvin Brazil Jr. We invite you to visit us on Facebook at Execution Watch or online at executionwatch.org. Join our mailing list for all of the latest updates. And please stop by kpft.org to show your support for this program and others, and make your secure contribution to this station. I want to thank our panel, Larry B. Douglas, Jack Lee, Mike Gillespie, and Paige Yannick, Death House reporter Linda Hujan, executive producer Elizabeth Stein, and our engineer Bob Gartner for their assistance on today's program. Up next, Coming to America with Gordon Kwan. On behalf of the Execution Watch crew, I'm Marlo Blue. Good night. Jesus' name.